Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host, as always. And today we are joined by Andreas Lindner, the esteemed group CFO at Orior, a food and beverage group listed on the Swiss Stock Exchange. He's also a visionary in financial leadership. Andreas, a University of Basel alumnus, was recognized as CFO of the Year in 2018 by CFO Forum Schweiz, showcasing his exceptional skills in financial management. His journey includes pivotal roles at Ricola Group and Orior AG, where he has significantly contributed to their growth and success. Andreas is a champion of teamwork, believing in the power of collaboration to achieve outstanding results. And I've asked him to join us here today to share his story plus insights on finance, leadership, and the importance of teamwork in the corporate world. So Andreas, thank you so much for joining us, my friend. How are you doing?
Thanks, Daryl. Great to be here. I'm doing fine. Great. Yeah.
Good. I appreciate it. He woke up a little extra early for us to be here today. Very grateful and appreciative for that. Now, before we start talking about finance and leadership and teamwork, I always like to ask, how did you even get started in business? Is this a family career choice? Is this a family path? Were you guys looking at P&Ls around the dinner table when you were a kid, or?
And not really, actually. I started at the University of Basel and majoring in economics and business, because that's the major which opens up the door to a whole lot of opportunities. I didn't really know at that time where I wanted to end up. So I thought business economics would be a great way to start. And actually that's what happens during the studies. I get it more, and then eventually I then got my first job at Roche Pharmaceuticals in Basel, where it's headquartered. So that's what was a good start. Yeah.
Got it. So this is a new path. Your parents weren't in business at all, or did they have?
No, my father was an entrepreneur. He had his own business.
Okay.
In remodeling, painting, but I didn't want to step into the business. I wanted to pursue my own career. That's why I started to study economics and business. Yeah.
Got it. Okay, so walk us through your career journey and maybe some of the biggest challenges that you've had in your business career.
Yeah, actually, it's been quite a long career already. Now looking at 30 years back in the finance function. As I said, I started at Roche Pharmaceuticals, a very successful Swiss pharmaceutical company. There was a lot of learning. I could really feel my backpack professionally very fast. After 2 years in headquarters, I got an expat assignment in South America. I spent 5 years in Argentina, Buenos Aires, and Uruguay, Montevideo. Great experience. As a young guy, being able to go quickly abroad, take responsibilities, learn a whole lot. I even had to learn Spanish very quickly because basically nobody spoke German or even English. So that was a great experience. They throw in the cold water. You have to swim fast. So that was a great experience. And then after 7 years of Roche, I wanted to do something much more hands-on, because in a big multinational or international company, you're embedded where you have support from all sides, tax, legal, everything is very well organized. And I wanted to be a bit more hands-on. And then I got an offer to join the Mövenpick Group as a CFO of the Fine Foods division, which was a not very successful fine foods company. I was looking at the ice cream business, the jam, the coffee, and so forth. So it was a lot of restructuring. And this was really the complete opposite of Roche. Roche, very well organized, successful, and then Mövenpick, turnaround candidate, restructuring.
What do you mean for the people? Sorry to interrupt, but when you say restructuring, what does that mean?
We had loss-making businesses in Asia. The company was basically only profitable in Switzerland and in the European countries. Basically, we had to close down much of the Asian operations. We bought a company before my arrival in New Zealand, and that company we also had to basically restructure. So there was a lot of turnaround, stop the bleeding, getting back to profitability. So the CEO and myself, actually, we started on the same day. We had to really turn around this fine food business. And eventually then we sold it to Nestle. This was something we didn't expect, but Nestle approached us, and then we sold it to Nestle, which was another great experience, selling, being on the selling side and selling this ice cream, and mainly the ice cream business to Nestle. That was a great experience. So I got both experiences. Roche, very successful, stable, learned a lot. Then Mövenpick, action, hands-on, a lot of different things.
Need to improve.
yeah, exactly. Like a lot of potential, exactly. And then after Mövenpick, I had a short stay at a tobacco company, which was also something completely new, very interesting. But I only stayed there for a year and a half before then switching in the medtech industry. I worked for Synthes AO. It is a medtech group, also very successful. And also there, a very interesting assignment to separate the Synthes, the stock-listed commercial company, with AO Foundation, which is the development and instruction platform, kind of unbundle it, separate it.
So that was legally or in terms of,
yes, legally, because it was very much interlinked in terms of the, for example, the patents, the IP was always AO. Even the brand name Synthes was owned by AO, and therefore we had to basically sell the IP, the assets, and unbundle the two structures. So that was my main tasks. Also arrange the new financing opportunities for the AO Foundation. So that was a really interesting task for about 2.5 years. And then eventually I got asked to join the Ricola Group, the Swiss cough drop company, as the group CFO.
Oh, Ricola, I know you guys.
Yeah, exactly.
Ricola. I know
exactly.
Those commercials.
Exactly, Ricola, exactly. So that was a very interesting offer. And of course, I accepted, I joined the group. And then for over 11 years, I stayed there for almost 11 years. I could really transform the finance function, help the company modernize the processes. So that was really a fantastic experience. And then after 10 years, I thought, should I stay another 10 years or end up in Itra? Or should I look at something new? And then, as it happens, I got an offer to join a stock listed company in the food and beverage area, which was another step. It's much, much bigger, much more complex. And then I accepted, and I'm now in my fifth year. And it's really interesting. It's exactly what I wanted at that time. Yeah.
That's fantastic. I've got so many kind of questions I want to ask about different things. Mm-hmm. Before I jump into those, what would you recommend to someone who's running a small business? They've survived COVID somehow, but maybe they're just starting a new business after COVID and they're struggling. Because you talk about having restructured and having to take a look at doing turnarounds, what are some of the fundamentals that you would consider in terms of what do you do when a ship is sinking, so to speak? Where do you start? And was there a first assessment that you need to do? How do you prioritize decisions? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. Yeah, first you need to do a health check to see where is the issue. And usually it starts with the cash flow. Really look at where cash flow comes from, where it goes to. I think cash is king. Cash is the oxygen of any business. So that's the first thing, to look at the cash situation, cash flow statement. That's key. And then secondly, look at where are the strengths. Where do you have a competitive edge? Where are the strengths, where you can really excel and drive the business, and where is you bleeding? Where are you losing money, or where you're not successful, where you're not competitive? So try to filter out these areas and try to get a picture of the overall situation. But always first start with cash, because that's in the end, that's the key. Huh? That's the key.
Cash is king. Got it. Okay.
So
take a clear analysis of the cash flow statement. Mm-hmm. Figure out where the cash is coming in from, where is it going, take a look at the strengths, what's working really well, look at where you're
bleeding,
see if you can get rid of it. Is it necessary?
And the customer base. Look at the customer base. Which are the top customers? Can you grow with them? Where are the customers where you're basically losing money or not progressing? And try to differentiate and filter out and focus really on your strengths and key areas. Yeah.
Are you talking about an RFM analysis of your customer base?
What do you mean RFM?
Recency, frequency, and monetary value.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So take a look at your top, like the Pareto principle, the 80-20. Take a look at the top 20. What customers give you 80% of the revenue? Mm-hmm. And then look at the bottom 20. And if you can get rid of the bottom 20 and try to do more for the, or get more, like the top 80%. That's a really good, that's a really good checklist.
Yeah.
Okay. So now, I'm going to be jumping around a little bit, but that was a great answer for that. Mm-hmm. My next question is actually something of personal interest in. Talk about separating IP and selling IP and legal structuring of IP. And I think there's a lot of businesses, myself included, that probably don't take advantage of this as well as they could in terms of, I don't know if so much about protecting their IP. I'm not experienced enough to speak to protecting it other than just trying to out-innovate your competition. But generally speaking, there's a lot of people that just walk by licensing deals that they don't even realize that they could capitalize on. They don't even necessarily understand what IP would be as an, how to use IP as an asset. Can you speak to that a little bit? Because it sounds like you may be in a place to know.
IP is incredibly important. It contains the brands, the Ricola brand, incredibly valuable and successful. We have brands. So brands are an incredible asset. You need to invest in brands. You need to maintain the brands, defend the brands. So you should really focus on brand value, on brand maintenance. That's the one thing. But eventually also, if you see that you cannot develop a brand yourself and that it would be in better hands, someone else, or eventually sell also brands. And that's what we did. But you need the dedicated resources to focus on brand value. And the second point is then the other IP, the customer lists and know-how developed inside. And that's another topic, which you have to work on it. You have to try to protect it, eventually file patents if possible. And also here, you just need dedicated resources. You should not neglect it. You should really have dedicated people to focus on it and get help from outside. We have also experts. We have external lawyers who help us with IP management.
So just for people, like I said, because a lot of our listeners are small, medium-sized businesses. So some ideas of IP is your brand name, brand value, reputation. That's what a brand means to me. It's the reputation. It's the recognition.
Yeah,
kind of the brand.
Yeah, know-how. Know-how.
The know-how. For a recipe or a specific process for doing something. And then you also mentioned IP can be things like your customer list.
Exactly.
Patents. I think patents is an easy one. A lot of people might know that. Can you speak to like other unique ones people maybe don't often consider, like a customer list? Why is a customer list IP? And what are other forms of maybe unrealized IP?
It's the customer list and also it's a customer relation, because you are building up customer relationship over years. And that's a value of the company. And therefore, this is something very important, being able to have a customer relationship, have customer lists, of course, the revenue. Your top 10 or your 80% customers are of big value for the whole company. So if you value companies, that's a big asset. And you have to take care of that. You have to maintain it. You have to protect it. And that's of value. So the customers, the know-how of your personnel, of your people, the process know-how, for example, reproducing plant-based products, which are the meat analogs. And we have developed on some of the articles very specific process know-how, recipes that are pretty unique. Right. And that's also a great know-how for the company. Even though anybody basically can buy a machine and produce plant-based products, the process know-how, the specifications, the technology, the configurations. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's exactly how do you configure the machines with temperature, pressure, air, and so on. That's also IP, because it gives you the ability to produce these high quality and specific products.
Is there any, and you may or may not be able to answer this, but how do you protect that with staff? Is there a method of compartmentalization or something that you would use? Because if you've got a team of 5-10 people perhaps in the plant that are working, for example, like your plant-based meat, those people already, they have the IP. What's to stop them from doing what that guy did in Jurassic Park, the movie where he sells the seed and just goes bring some embryos? How do you, can you speak to that a little bit in your experience? What is there a problem? Yeah.
First, it starts with treating your employees right. These are key employees. At Ricola, with the secret recipe, the people who produce the ROPs, also here with the plant-based business. Treat the employees right. Hold them on that they're being loyal to you. Treat them well. And that they have to be comfortable. If they leave the company, they will take some of the know-how with them. You don't want that. So make sure your employees are happy. They keep part of the staff. So that's the first thing. The second thing then is confidentiality agreements. You need to hold these areas confidential. So that's also very important to have access rights in the system, to be very specific about who can see what in the ERP system and so on. But it's all about people in the end. You have to tie them to your company, and that they are happy and they don't think about going somewhere else.
I love that, because in my experience, a contract is only as good as your ability to enforce it.
Exactly.
So you may have a contract, But at the end of the day, if you didn't take care of the people, they may not care. And even if they lose, they can still upset your apple cart for long enough to really make life miserable to deal with that. So I think that's a fantastic, I think that's a fantastic message to include in that. What are some of the specific skills or behaviors that you believe are important for C-suite management to improve or develop, having over your 30 plus years of experience?
I think there's several ingredients or aspects. First of all, I think you need to be flexible and agile nowadays. There's so many things changing every day, every week. So you need to be able to adapt, look at it in a new way. So be agile, stay curious. I think you need to be curious because that's the only way you get forward. Curious, learn, continuous learning, learn, unlearn, relearn. That's incredibly important. I think another aspect is you need to have a sense of humor. I think it's very important even for CFOs to have a sense of humor, to lighten up the discussion. Don't take yourself too seriously. And then the team player part, I think you cannot win alone. You never win alone. It's always a team effort. And therefore, you need to really collaborate well with your team. Try to recruit great people for the team. So I think this whole recruiting, the people aspect is getting more and more important. Mm. I think you should spend as much time as you can in recruiting the right people, because in the end, that's the people you work with. And if you have great talents around you, this also makes yourself and the whole team much more successful. These are, for me, the key ingredients. And then besides all the professional, the competences which have to be there, but stay curious, be flexible, have humor, and recruit well. Recruit, that's extremely important.
Can you speak to the fundamentals maybe of team building? And every business is different, what excellence would be for them. That makes sense. But what sort of transferable principles do you think are important for developing a culture within a company? Like, how do you influence the culture of your team, and how do you facilitate team building in your experience, in your point of view?
I think as a leader, you first of all, you need to set an example. With if you are open, if you are sincere, and if then the team also is adopting to it. So I think you have to lead by example. You have to be open. You have to also communicate a lot and well with the team. I think it's very important to have very close collaboration and relationship with each of the team members. With my direct reports, I talk to them almost every day. I would say even every day I talk to them. We talk about business stuff. We talk about also private stuff. So I think it's important to have a very close relationship and know exactly how they tick, to know them, to know what they like to do, what they don't like to do, and also be able to empower and delegate. I try to delegate as much as I can to my team members. Then I help them. If they ask me, I can support them. I coach them. I try not to be directive and tell them what to do, because actually I hire people that they can tell us how to do it better and how to develop us. So we're not hiring people and then it exactly tell them what to do. So I think it's just the way of collaborating. As a leader, I think you should lead by example, communicate a lot, give them targets and then let them run, and be there to answer questions, to support them, to coach them. So that's for me the what the leader is all about, being like a playing coach on the field.
I love that. And everything you said really matches up with the research that I've done. I may or may not have mentioned before that I spent $50,000 to hire 10 assistants to help me go through all the academic literature on business success from around the world to figure out what are the commonalities, irrespective of culture and government and even economy. And we found 8 critical success factors. And one of them we termed self-efficacy. And then we dove into the pieces of all 8. And the 3 kind of pillars of self-efficacy are personality traits, leadership skills, and personal disciplines. And for leadership skills, what our research showed, it's not about vision. That's more market intelligence and strategic planning. But leadership is about self-awareness, communication, cooperation skills, emotional intelligence, adaptability. And then the personality traits that we found in the research most positively correlated with success were things like locus of control, which you're saying when you hire people that you just give them control. You don't hire people that you have to micromanage. You hire people that not only can they perform, but they might come back with suggestions, and you just hold them accountable to the outcome, not necessarily how to do it. So you give them locus of control, being a control freak, but with a control. The other personality traits were extroversion, openness to experience, agreeableness, conscientiousness, and acceptance of criticism and feedback. And I thought that was really great, because that's, you said it all in your own words, but I feel like you just confirmed all of my research there. Could have saved me $50,000, Andreas. I'm kidding.
Something else I use is the OKR system with my direct reports. We have the objective and key results. We do on a quarterly level. So for each quarter, we define 3 or 4 main objectives. And then the key results, how do you get there? So we basically have a quarterly target setting. And we have weeklies, formal weeklies, where every week we sit together and we talk about the OKR points, where I can support, where they need help, and so on. But basically, I let them run and according to the OKR objectives for each quarter. Mm-hmm.
So how do you currently approach employee training and development then within your org to help people continue to improve and grow?
I do it very individually, which each direct report. As I said, we have the weeklies, the formal weeklies. Then we have the daily discussions. And it's very on a situative level. Some of them need much more support. They are more junior in their role. Some of them are very senior. Basically, they're on their own. So it really depends on the situation of each of those leaders. There's not one for all. It's very situative. It's individual. I listen a lot, and I listen, what do they have pain points? What's bothering them? How can I help them? Or where do they need my support in terms of presentations, or if there are argumentations, or if there's a CapEx project, what additional aspects we need to consider. But it's very individual. I wouldn't say there is one thing that fits for everybody.
And just help me understand more for the others. Is it on the C-suites to do the training? Is there an internal department for this? Or do you outsource that, delegate that, depending on the individual needs?
We have, we call it the Aurea Campus. We have a campus, a platform for different courses where the people can participate. For example, you can do a course in project management. It's on-site. It's also web-based. So we have specific competences where we teach on our campus. But in terms of leadership development, we are developing now a program for the campus, but also we leave it to the executives and to the leaders, because in the end, the people development leadership is very individual. And therefore, basically, I feel it's my job to take care of leadership aspects for my team and my direct reports.
Got it. So what are some of the habits that you feel are most important for yourself and the other leaders, whether they're daily or weekly? You hinted at a couple. You've got a quarterly OKR system. You have weekly huddles. Are there any other daily, weekly habits that you think are mission critical to success?
Well, very critical is coffee breaks. Coffee breaks and also lunch. I take them to lunch sometimes. We go out and then we try not to talk about business. So I think these are the kind of informal things which are extremely important also in terms of innovation. You bounce off ideas over a coffee. This is incredibly important. So that's what I think what helps also the team spirit. Then we do aperos. We get together for a drink after 5:30 or 6, have a beer together. So this is the glue also for the team. So these are the things which I think are very important for the team to collaborate well. Sometimes we do sports together. We go either play squash, tennis, or badminton, or go to the lake. So these are the activities which are important. And then also in terms of, for example, in the huddles we bounce off ideas how to approach certain challenges. We do the brainstorming, we collect the ideas, and then we try to come up with a team proposal. How would we approach that? What I also try to do is on certain topics, I try to talk to other companies. I'm still in contact with Ricola, for example. So with the IT guy, sometimes visit the Ricola IT guy. Also in HR, we exchange ideas with other companies, with peers. Before we introduce systems, we have reference visits. So there's actually quite a lot of exchange with other CFOs or IT, HR, or other experts in other companies, because they are basically having the same issues or challenges as we have. So we try to learn from each other.
I love that. That's really fantastic. And what, in your experience, you've probably had a lot of friends, whether family friends or friends of your kids or even staff that maybe move on from a company you're working at and start their own business. What are the greatest mistakes that you see other businesses and entrepreneurs making whenever you engage with them, or even as a consumer yourself, when you do business, you go and you're a customer somewhere? What are some of the biggest mistakes that you see businesses and entrepreneurs making?
That's a tough question to answer. It's very general. I would say one thing I noticed quite a lot is overconfidence. Overconfidence, especially in the startup scene. You have investors, you have VCs, you have a lot of funds suddenly. Yeah, overconfidence. I think even if you are starting up or if you're small, you need to be humble. You need to be, as I said, you need to be curious, learn, and really watch cash. Focus on the cash flow. Cash is key, especially when you start up. And take it step by step. Don't take too big bites. Only bite what you can chew and go step by step. And you have seen it with a lot of companies now in the media. With other companies, they had a huge growth and suddenly they collapsed. So take it step by step. Focus on the people. Again, recruiting is key. Get the best people around you. Spend as much time as you can on recruiting. Hire very slow, but then fire fast. If it doesn't work, be fast. So the key aspect is also the people side. Get yourself around. You have to have people around you which help you to develop. And you don't need people who always agree to everything you say. You need people who to be critical, to be supportive, to be collaborative. So that's a bit the ingredients, I would say. And don't be overconfident. Don't be too overconfident.
We watched Blockbuster go bankrupt, newspapers, music industry. So it sounds like you're saying for you, two of the really big pillars are having a very big cash runway and hyper-focusing on recruiting, hiring slow, firing fast, making sure you have the right people in the right seats, doing the right things, and almost not even really some training, okay, but generally looking to hire people that are going to bring more to the company. Now, how does that play into paying premium salaries, right? How do you attract top talent? I know there's some people listening that may be curious about that. Is it just more money?
You rather have one or two people less, but then pay them more. So in the end, it's the same, but we try to be always at the, we try to hire as few people as possible, but the ones we have, we really want to have the superior talents. So in the end, we are extremely lean. Even here at the headquarters, we are headquartered of a stock listed company. We have about 15 people, but which is extremely few. Everybody has more than one job. So that's also try to be ultra lean. But those people you have, you really treat well. You treat them well financially. You treat them well psychologically from the team aspect. And don't have too much staff. Don't water down the staff level. Just really focus on a few, but key people.
Now, what about a role like sales or something like that, which is notorious for a high churn rate?
I mean, it's the same on sales. It's the same on sales. It's to try to have really extraordinary people. And also here, I would say variable salary is key, of course. You need to have variable salaries for salespeople. But the fixed salary should also be important because, as was demonstrated, financial incentives do not always increase motivation.
Right. So in fact, sometimes they decrease.
Exactly. So therefore, you need to be very careful. You have to have a fair and good fixed part. And then the variable part should be there, but it should not be excessive. It should be rather moderate. And then again, treat them well.
Yeah, I love that. So now, as someone who's been in business for a while, for a minute, a year or two, and knowing what's happening in the world, we've got a lot happening geopolitically. There's a lot happening economically. There's some people, myself included, who seem to feel there's an unelected body of individuals with a specific agenda going on in the world. What are you paying attention to coming down the pipeline? What are some of the things that are on your radar that you're watching closely that you think other people should pay attention to over the next 5-10 years?
Personally, I think I would say focus on what is important for you and what you can influence. Focus. There are so many things you could worry about and that could distract you and take time from you. But the key is focus. focus on your key goals, on what you can really influence, what's important, and then and dedicate time to these areas. But don't get distracted by all those. I could worry about energy. I could worry about so many things. But really, don't get distracted. Focus. I think that's the nowadays with so many things going on. That's more important than ever.
I love that. I love that a lot. But focus. One of my mentors once said, "Focus is actually an acronym. It's not a word." Now he's just being silly, but it means follow one course until successful.
Yes. There's so much power in focusing, and in the corporate world, companies which are defocusing, getting distracted, also in personal life. I think that's more important than ever than stay on the focus on something, stay on the course. Also in investing, the same. Have your asset allocation, focus on the asset allocation. Don't get into trading, short-term trading. Really stay the course and sharp on the focus.
You just made me think of another question I hadn't actually thought about. So I'm curious, we've done research and you've already spoken to this a little bit, but one of the things we, in our research, one of the key success factors was money management. And the pillars that we found of successful money management in a company was low capital investment, leanness, debt-free, heavy R&D spending, spending in high quality products and services, spending in asset and sales growth, and then of course, capacity utilization, which is a fancy word for making the most you can with what you got. What would you put as subcategories over asset and sales growth? If a company were to invest in assets and sales growth, what do you think? You talk about asset allocation. What we talked about IP a little bit. We talked about sales teams. Are there other things that you would put under? If I asked you to make the bullet points under that heading, under money management, what would you put under asset and sales growth?
I would add something that's also, the, as I said before, cash flows and cash allocations. That's always start with cash. And then the contribution margin, I would also add. It's very important to know exactly of your product categories, of your of also of your assets, which are more or less profitable. So contribution margins are key. So if you have full control over your cash, if you have full control over your contribution margin by category or by product, that's already a big plus, place plus to start. Then the other thing is, again, on the people side, personnel costs and the people, the competence level of the people. And then again, stay curious, be a little paranoid about the competition, about the market, always be looking around, be curious, paranoid. And then everything should fall into place, because then you're basically set up for success.
That's a great answer. That's a powerful answer. Andreas, this has been a great interview. I've got a couple of pages of notes. I'm curious, is there anything I haven't asked you yet that I should have asked you?
I think we have covered most of the points. I think maybe one aspect which I should mention, because besides the professional career, I've also dedicated a lot of time in my athletic career, and a lot of comparables and parallels between business and sports.
Right.
Probably you can also talk about this, because you have also had an athletic career, and especially in individual sports, I'm a tennis player. There were a lot of things I could draw from tennis that helped me in business and vice versa. And therefore I would really encourage people to also pursue sports, even individual sports, early, because that would help them to develop their personality and also give them skills that would be important for business afterwards.
Yeah, and I feel like some people, they live in such a world of video games and online tech, they don't fully appreciate, it does take time to develop skills in a video game, sure, but it's different when it's so multifaceted. You talk about tennis, there's the physical attributes, the mental attributes, there's understanding your competitors and who you're up against, the environment, environmental conditions. What are some of the key takeaways that you've had from tennis to the business world?
First of all, in business and also in tennis, there's the technical aspect. Tennis or golf or what, take it. They're very technical sports. Also business, you need technical skills, how to approach something, even how to manage your outlook, your inbox, how to, they are working technical skills, there are in athletic skills. So you need to dominate and master these technical skills. Then there are tactical aspects. How do you approach a negotiation? What are the elements for negotiation? How do you proceed in a merger or in an M&A transaction? The same is true for tennis. How do you approach the opponent? What's the game plan for that? The same, then the third point is discipline. You need to be disciplined, man. It's the same in tennis, with training, with practice, with matches, and in business the same. You have to be disciplined. I'm in the office basically every day at 7 a.m. So you have to be follow this path. Then is the mental aspect. It's extremely mental business. You have tough times with competition, with employees, with bosses, with boards, whatever. The same in tennis. It's very mental. If you're on the third set, the tie break, the mental that counts. And then you need also you need to be able to handle defeats, victories, in business and in sports. And the same is true for the optimism. You need to be optimistic. You need to look forward. You need to be positive. You need to have a sense of humor. The same is in business and in sports. And yeah, so that's a bit the parallels and which apply to both disciplines. Huh?
Yeah, for my career, I've been mostly in like athletics and martial arts, like Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And that, and I think there's immense parallels. We already spoke to some of them. And again, to recap people, there's the technical aspect. There's being able to do what you need to do. And then there's the tactical aspect, which is also the strategy, right? The strategy behind
Exactly.
Looking for leverage. That's a huge thing. Yeah. A lot of people don't realize it, but like submission grappling, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, it's people see chokes and arm bars that, but it's actually a game of inches, probably tennis too.
Exactly. Like
you turn the racket too much this way, too much that way. Across the court, that's a huge difference in where.
Yeah, it's all physics. All physics.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And then last but not least, what I didn't mention, but it's the team. In business, you only excel with the team. And the same in tennis, you never win alone. You never win alone. It's always behind you. It's the sparring partner, it's the coaches, the physio. It's never, the victory is never used alone.
I love that. I was fortunate enough to train with a lot of world champions and even an Olympic a medalist or two. And one of the things that I felt that I took away from it, and I haven't asked any of them, but my observation was, is that when somebody goes and wins the gold medal or they win the world championship at something, it's never a surprise to them in the sense that they know their competitors' benchmarks and they're beating them in training. They're training to beat them. So they know their competitors' benchmarks. They know their competitors' strengths and weaknesses. And it's like the whole cry and bleed in training, not on the battlefield. And so the date of the Olympics, the date of the world championships, that's not the day that the world champion is determined. That's just the day that everybody else gets to find out.
Yeah, exactly. Because
it's discovered beforehand in the behind closed doors with the team, and the coaches, in the training, in the beating, setting benchmarks, in the battle testing of different environments, training in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. We used to train with one arm tied from time. I saw that in a movie, Red Belt afterward. We would train with planned disadvantages because things will happen on game day. When the best people, these people that are the GOATs, the greatest of all time in their field, it's never a surprise to them when you see them win. It's just the day that everybody else finds out. And I think that's so powerful that if people took that approach with their hobbies, that there's a lot of lessons that could be brought into the business world. Yeah. Andreas, this has been such a wonderful interview. I'm so grateful for your time. Is there anything else you would like to add before we...
No, that's it. Basically, I hope I could add some value and give you some insights from my career and my experience. I have nothing left. Now you know it all.
If anybody has any questions, comments, or concerns, or wants to reach out and get in touch, what are some of the best ways for them to reach out to you?
Yeah, I think the best is LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn. I check it regularly. So if you want to get in touch with me or ask questions or exchange some ideas, just contact me on LinkedIn. That's the easiest.
Perfect. So go check him out on LinkedIn. Andreas Lindner, AndreasLindner. You know you've got the right one if he's in Switzerland and with Orior AG from the University of Basel. Is that right?
Basel, yeah.
Basel, there we go. Basel, sorry. Andreas, thank you so much. It has been an honor and a pleasure. A lot of value in this. People may want to listen to it more than once to make sure they got all the goods. And I know you've got people that are trying to get your attention to that. And you've got your own team, your own family, your own people to take care of. So thank you for coming and sharing with me. And
no, it's a pleasure.
Better.
All right.
Thank you so much. All right.
No, thank you very much, Daryl. Pleasure. Awesome. On mine. Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you.